day shooting before his eyes, the rag clutched in his fingers. By mid-afternoon, the blaze and the storm had arrived, Volker and the Mercedes leading the royal wagon up the stained hill and into Backer Fort. The fires doused now, but the bastion blackened and still smoking. Hattu followed, almost in a trance. Up there he saw the generals of the day were inside, Karunta and Nuanza lashed with dirt, sweat and blood, Volker unsullied. A noise behind him caught him unawares, a weak moan. He twisted to see the now lowered timber crossbar and the gruesome pennant of poor Ruba's body, almost forgotten in the mayhem of the battle, still twitching, his lips still quivering as if trying to talk. A pair of royal healers were crouched by the old teacher, but their sagging shoulders and sad faces said it all.
"There is nothing we can do to save him," the nearest said. "He is in great pain."
Hattu's throat thickened fiercely as he knelt by the old fellow's side, clasping his hand, the fingers already cold. Karunta knelt with him, clutching a short dagger.
"Old goose," the general said, his voice hoarse.
A short, sharp nick across Ruba's neck, and his torment was over. Silence reigned. A warm, late afternoon breeze lifted Karunta's silvery braid of hair, and Hattu was sure he saw a single, crystal-like teardrop fall from the grizzled general's bowed head and blot the dirt.
"Farewell, old tutor,"
Hattu mouthed, tears openly streaking his dirt-stained cheeks. Arrow settled lightly on his shoulder, emitting one long, elegiac cry. The somber moment ended with an eruption of scuffling and shouting. From behind the armory in one corner of the fort, two Hittite soldiers dragged the thrashing Darizu from some rat hole he had been hiding in. The Galasman was kicked to his knees before King Mercili's wagon. A weak, white hand peeled the veil back, and Mercili looked out, his lopsided face like a wraith's. Darizu's pig eyes widened and his features paled.
"The Kaskans arrived here first, and they came in great number," he stammered, the words falling over one another. "They said they would burn our families alive unless we sided with them. Those who resisted their demands fought fiercely but were overcome. And then Pataga burnt them in high awful pyres made purely of bodies, fires that only this morning breathed their last."
Hattu thought of the smoke pall that had drawn them here, and let his eyes close to rid himself of the image. But in its place he saw the strip of cloth and all it meant.
"It cannot be true.
They threatened to gut me and let hawks pick at my innards if I didn't deceive you from the fort walls. What were we to do?"
he pleaded. His thick silver necklace, a Kaskan piece, jangled with his every gesticulation, undermining his every word.
"You could have stayed loyal to your Labana,"
Mercili said flatly.
"Donned the armor and spears I had sent for your fighting men, and stood alongside the few who resisted. Together, the Galasmans might well have fended off the Kaskan advance until we arrived. You had that choice, Darizu, but you chose instead to betray me, and to betray your ancestors."
Darazu's head turned, eyes searching the merciless faces. There was a moment where his pig eyes widened with some inner realization.
"Spare me, my son,"
he said, turning back to the king.
"And I can tell you everything."
A shiver shot up Hattu's back. Darizu had known the king was coming. How? Mercili sat up too, quivering and pale within the carriage. Darizu nodded hurriedly.
"Everything."
Suddenly, 3 points burst from the man's breast with a shower of dark blood, his head shooting back and his face contorting like that of a stunned fish. Volker placed one foot on the Galasman leader's shoulder and wrenched his trident free, kicking the corpse onto its face.
"Have you lost your mind?"
Karunta said, rising from beside Ruba's body.
"A dead traitor won't tell us much, will he?"
"His voice was boring me," the Sherdan said with a smirk. "And he was armed," he added,
pulling a small skinning knife from Darizu's belt. Hattu gazed at the dead traitor, pink froth bubbling from the 3 grim holes in his back, at Ruba, his oldest mentor, at the scores of bodies lying riven, mangled, and mutilated all around the fort, at the swarms of flies and buzzing and birds picking at the cadavers, and the rag in his hand felt like an ingot of lead.
"And what of Pitaga?"
King Masili croaked.
"Pitaga lives,"
Hattu said flatly. He felt his father's scornful eyes on him.
"Then we cannot return home,"
the king tremored, the effort clearly sapping what little strength he had.
"We may have foiled Pitaga's trap today, but the Lord of the Mountains has succeeded in destroying our generation's old alliance with Galasma. This frontier is broken. We must continue to the lost north. We must hunt Pitaga down."
"My son,"
Nuanza, standing by the carriage, protested in a whisper that was inadvertently loud. "And the north is unknown, treacherous. Those mountains." Volker sidled over to the carriage, much to Nuanza's annoyance, addressing the king but speaking loud enough for all to hear.
"On the Isle of Sheridan we used to suffer bandits. Swift and spry, they would fall upon our trade wagons like wildcats, and then melt back into the rugged slopes of the Fire Mountain. Gone!"
He flashed the fingers of both hands before him.
"Like shadows. One of my greatest mistakes was in thinking that by driving them back, we had beaten them. Because they, like these mountain men, always come back stronger, like weeds. Heed your king. Outright victory is the only kind we should seek."
"We will regroup and tend to our wounded,"
Masili wheezed.
"Then we will cross the mountains. We will find Pitaga."
He shook a weak left fist.
"Into the lost north!"
A muted cheer met this proclamation, amplified by a short, whistling breeze. Hattu swung to the north, to the Carrion Gorge and its rising path through the soaring mountains. The notion of marching there seemed like nothing. The rag was everything. He eyed the strip of cloth once more, then heard approaching footsteps. He looked up to see his brother. Mua's face was like a quarry, his frown lines like deep cuts, his gaze stonier than any of the whisperers had ever been.
"Brother, you are hurt,"
Hattu said, seeing a thin red slash on his face from the edge of an axe. "The wound is decoration, nothing more," Mua snapped.
"You and the Fury saved us," Hattu said.
"We did. Yet the men speak of you as the champion of the day,"
Mua muttered darkly, his tone a war of jealousy and grudging respect.
"There was no victory today, brother,"
Hattu said softly, handing Mua the piece of cloth.
"What is this?"
Mua scowled.
"It is a strip, torn from a priestess's robe,"
Hattu replied, his throat thickening.
"Pitaga had it. Pitaga has her."
"What?"
Mua gasped, his face crumpling.
"They must have ambushed the wagons of the temple folk on the way to Topeka. The divine statue, the eagle kin, the priestesses. A tear."
Mua took a step back from Hattu.
"I put her well-being in your hands, Hattu,"
he croaked. Hattu felt a fire creep across his skin. All around him he heard whispers and then laments as the men of the army realized what had happened. The silver effigy of Tahunda, the holiest of holies, had fallen into Kaskan hands. Their beloved priestesses had been carried off too.
"Tahunda, forgive us!"
one soldier cried out, falling to his knees.
"I trusted you to choose an able escort,"
Mua continued.
"I did," Hattu insisted. "The Eagle Kin are a strong company, and were a strong company,"
Mua interrupted.
"And I raised horse scouts from Father's stable, too,"
Hattu snarled, anger rising in his breast.
"What more could I have done? You should have chosen a second company. You should have sent them on the high road. Shorter and swifter,"
Mua snarled.
"Brother, I did as I thought right. A single company is the normal escort, and the high road? Are there not bandits on its stretches, too?"
But Mua's lips grew thin, and his nostrils flared. He backed away from Hattu, shaking his head.
"You claim to love her, yet you let her fall into the hands of the vilest of creatures."
He took another step back, stabbing a finger at Hattu.
"This is your doing,"
Enough!
A frail voice called from nearby. Hatu and Mua looked to the royal wagon, seeing the trembling king, eyes wide, face pale. With a snort, Mua turned his back and strode away. Hatu's heart wrapped with dread. His mind screamed 1,000 different words of justification and curses, and his eyes blazed with fury. Chapter 15. Into the Lost North, early summer 1300 BC. The army remained at Bakka Fortress for 11 days, tending to the stricken, digging graves and building pyres. Old Ruba was cremated with onyx by his side. Priests' incantations were unrelenting as the dead were consigned to the dark earth, and the weak and sometimes blood-curdling cries of the wounded grew gradually fewer as the mortally injured faded and the rest grew strong again. At the end of it all, 107 Hittite warriors had fallen in the fray, 39 of them from the Mountain Wolves. A tiny fraction of the army, but each of them grieved for like fallen brothers. They spent another day replenishing the baggage wagons with game caught in and berries foraged from the woods and water from the Green River. On the 12th day, they left Hittite lands behind, setting forth into the Carrion Gorge, cutting deep into the soaring mountains, realm of the Kaskans. The gorge was like the throat of a giant, wide, spacious, and carpeted in soft moss at first. Then, after the first day of marching, it became tight, twisting and rocky underfoot. And despite the illusion of freshness lent by the snowy mountain peaks that loomed high above, these lower parts were uncomfortably hot, with the air in the gorge still and arid, the silvery sides of the corridor reflecting and multiplying the early summer heat. A vanguard of Nuanza's champion archers moved like spiders along the high sides of the passageway, in case Pitaga had merely moved his gorge snare a few danna further northwards. They went barefoot, scuttling along in just kilts, scouting the caves, niches, and ambush points along those heights, and signalling back to the column. Hatu and the wolves marched in their place within the chain of the three great divisions, but there was less chatter than there had been in the march through Hittite lands. He felt acutely aware of the shrunken pack around him. 39 young men, mere boys just a summer ago. Boys who had trained with him in the Red Fells, who had resented him once, but had grown to love him as one of their own, were gone. Looking across the soldiers on this front rank with him, he saw Tanku and Dagon, but no Garin. Just as Hatu had beaten Kurunta's challenges and become accepted in the ranks, so too Garin had shed his extra weight, turning from a chubby recruit into a lean, confident warrior. He remembered Garin's tales about his beloved mother and pet cats, and felt the urge to weep for her, alone in Hattusa, unaware of her son's death. He noticed Kurunta just ahead. The one-eyed general seemed to be marching with invisible weights tied to his shoulders, his head uncharacteristically down. Ruba's death and the fallen at Bakka had hit him hard, it seemed. It stoked in Hatu something he never thought he would feel for Kurunta. Pity. Pity and a memory of something from that cold winter he had spent at the Fields of Bronze, a chorus he had heard Kurunta singing alone in the barracks. Tahunda weeps and the rain pours, he began nervously. A few paces ahead he saw Karunta's ears pick up. His lightning blinds, his thunder roars, he continued. A few others joined in. I'll fall and sing his ageless song. More were roused to sing along. The gorge trembled, such was the strength of the baritone doggerel.
And in our hearts they're never gone,
Karunta sang louder than any other, his head twisting to look back, his lone eye narrowing to a crescent as it settled upon Hatu. 2 more days passed, with the Hittite column making slow progress through the gorge. Tanku muttered an oath as he slipped and nearly turned an ankle on a loose rock for the third time that day. Hatu looked over his shoulder across the ranks of the storm. Back there he saw the mules and ox wagons laboring over this torturous ground. The army could only move as fast as this vital sumpter train. Dagon pulled the collar of his linen vest to try to usher in a breath of air. His face was streaked with sweat, and his thin hair was matted to the sides of his face.
"Too damned hot,"
he panted. Hattu tried to reply, but his throat was coated in dust, and it came out as a cough. He envied Arrow, gliding in a breeze near the front of the column as an aerial vanguard of sorts. There was some commotion in the front ranks of the Fury when she evacuated her bowels over one hulking red-faced soldier. The drowsy, hot march seemed to lose its sense of danger, until a sudden urgent call from up ahead echoed sharply from the gorge sides.
Halt!
Angry curses split the air, as nervous soldiers, surprised by the sudden stop, marched into the back of the men ahead. They quickly righted themselves, each division bringing their spears level, ready to react. But after a short silence, the order was given to continue. Hattu saw the cause of concern as the storm division marched past a stretch of flat ground where the gorge swelled. A large Kaskan settlement, or at least one of the seasonal camps they built in and around these mountains. It consisted of several hundred timber shacks and domes of mud and twigs, each a home for a dozen or so. These mud huts were dried out and broken, shards of the domes having fallen in like holes in smashed skulls, and the many black stains of campfires dotting the ground had grass growing through them, a sure sign the place had been abandoned some time ago.
"My father used to talk of these mountains as the home of the Kaskans," Dagon said, eyeing the deserted settlement. "I always imagined the peaks to be crawling with them, like ants on a nest."
He shrugged.
"Where are they?"
"Retreating," Tanku said confidently, eyeing the north. 10,000 strong, I heard. They don't have the numbers to beat us."
"Drawing us further from familiar ground," Hattu said, his face stony. "Where our greater numbers might mean little, where many more tribes of uncertain fealty roam." They passed three more Kaskan settlements, broken, derelict shells like the first one, during the following day. The heat continued to rob the marching men of their vigor, but things slowly changed as the path rose with the surrounding mountains, the route becoming more of a high pass than a gorge, studded with dark green conifer thickets and alive with the chirping of sparrowhawks. When they rose into the smaller peaks, the air became decidedly fresh. Some men even took to pulling their woolen cloaks from their bags and throwing them over their shoulders. The cool, dry winds up here moaned through the crags and caused men's lips to crack and throats to grow hoarse. They climbed into the upper peaks and were soon so high that goats in the gullies below resembled tiny insects. They even marched over patches of rock that were veined with frost, so cold it was, with one nearby peak clad in snow, a white streak of ice crystals being whipped from its summit by the winds. Vultures and eagles cried out overhead, and Arrow got caught up in a tussle with one angry raptor. They marched until twilight obscured the precarious path, and they could go forwards no more. Strewn along the high pass, they camped that night in the chilly heights, wind moaning around them and causing their bivouac tents to rap fiercely. Hattu helped Tanku, Dagon, and a clutch of the wolves to set up their tents, then threw himself down on the rocky ground in Kurunta-esque fashion, sure that a deep, exhausted, and dreamless sleep was soon to follow. Mua sat by the royal carriage, hearing from within his father's weak breaths, each digging into him like a spade. The chill wind rocked the wagon with every gust, and the shutters and curtains, supposedly sealing the carriage's interior off from the elements, rattled and creaked.
"Labana should not be up here," Mua said. "The mountain air is for the young and the strong."
Across the small fire, Nuanza washed the last bite of his bread down with a mouthful of water, his three tight tails of hair billowing in the latest gust of cold wind.
"There is a fire in his eyes yet, Tukanti."
A scuff of boots brought both men's heads round to the figure approaching the carriage. A horned helm, a billowing red cloak, a fierce trident.
"Watch out, arsehole approaching,"
Nuanza muttered under his breath.
"The Labana is asleep?"
Volka asked, halting by the small fire, his pale features and copper accoutrement ablaze in the reflected light.
"Aye, it would seem so,"
Mua replied absently. Volker nodded a few times, as if in some inner dialogue.
"And the men have not seen their king on his feet once during this march. It is not ideal for morale."
If he is ill, he is ill, Muwa snapped. Why fret over that which we cannot change?
True, true,
Volka replied.
In any case, I've been talking with the men of the ranks. It seems they have a new hero of sorts, one whose presence is partly making up for the king's continued malaise.
Muwa's ears pricked up.
Your young brother,
Volka beamed, crouching to warm his hands by the flames.
They talk in fulsome tones about Hattu. They laud him, as they do you, Tukanti.
He squared his shoulders and rested his trident butt on the ground, staring off into the night with a mock heroic gaze.
Son of Ishtar. That's what they call him.
Muwa felt the words sting his skin like a nettle. The men are fickle. Let them praise who they wish, as long as they are loyal to the Labana, he said, annoyed that his tone sounded terser than he had intended.
The way some speak, it's as if they'd rather see the son of Ishtar as their Labana. Can you imagine?
Volker's shoulders rocked with laughter.
But then again, like you, he has all the attributes.
Muwa shot to his feet and swept by the Gal Mercedi.
I'll check on the sentries.
Was it something I said?
Volker asked wide-eyed. Nuanza stoked at the embers of the fire with a twig, his eyes narrow and his lips thin.
Every word to the Labana or his issue should be measured and worthy. Keep idle chatter for the Arzana houses.
You've never liked me, have you, Bowman?
Volker chuckled.
I don't make friends easily, Nuanza shrugged. My trust is hard won.
Volker stood, stretching.
Aye, perhaps. You are the king's longest-serving general, are you not? I can see why he values you so.
His playful expression faded, and he bowed from the neck.
I have some way to go, to even deserve a place in your shadow.
Nuanza's eyes narrowed further.
I will do all I can to prove myself. That's what I came to tell you. I cannot sleep, so I'm taking a few scout riders out to look around while it's dark, up onto the mountain spine. Perhaps we'll be able to spot the Kaskan camp beyond. Their night fires will be like beacons.
Nuanza looked up, his high forehead wrinkling.
Night scouts. I think the Tukanti should be the one to sanction the idea.
Volker sighed and looked off into the night in the direction Muwa had gone.
And the Tukanti is in no mood for conversation, it would seem. I will be back not long after daybreak.
King Masili heard taunting voices in his fitful sleep, his son's exchange of fiery words at Baka Fortress echoing over and over. He saw a ring of bulls standing in a circle, pushing his two boys towards one another. Hattu and Muwa fought back at first, batting the animals on the nose with the flats of their swords, but try as they might, they could not break free of the pen of beasts. Suddenly, Muwa asked for help from Hattu, but Hattu snapped at him in reply, too busy trying to batter back one of the bulls to come to Muwa's aid. Muwa snarled some curse in response. They fought the bulls valiantly and slew them. But a moment later, the pair swung to face one another, their heated words exploding into shouts. Beyond the ring of bulls, he saw a tall, curvaceous, winged woman watching on from a veil of shadow. In her palm, she held a silver chair. Blood dripped down its back and the armrests.
And so it begins,
Ishtar whispered. King Masili sat up with a start, his right arm propping up his useless left side. Despite the perishing mountain wind that searched and shook the carriage, his skin was drenched with cold sweat, and his grey locks were plastered to his face and neck. The noise of trotting hooves sounded, fading into the north. He pulled the curtain and shutter there open. Fading into the darkness of night, he saw three scouts riding off along the pass, up and over the mountain spine, into the lost north. Confused, he fell back, panting, groaning. Despite aching shoulders, burning calves and throbbing feet, Hattu found sleep hard to come by. His body longed for rest, but his mind sought answers.
Atiya, where are you?
Silence barred the bivouac cloth flapping in the stiff wind. He opened one eye. The five other wolves under the shelter with him were sound asleep, using their woolen cloaks as blankets, comically hugging one another like nested bowls for extra warmth. Hattu rose, drawing his cloak around his shoulders, tossing his leather bag over one arm, thinking a light snack might help him feel drowsy. As he walked to the edge of the irregular camp, the pale light of a low moon portrayed the soaring mountains like a frozen sea of sharp white crests and grey plunging troughs. Clouds scudded across the moon from time to time, their shadows creeping across the mountains.
Arma, god of the moon, watch over us. Watch over Atia, he muttered, placing a hand over his heart.
The gods are cruel,
a voice said, a few paces away from him. Unnoticed, Karunta had settled down on a rock nearby. Dressed inexplicably in just the same leather kilt and cross-leather chestbands that he had been wearing in the boiling lower stretches of the gorge, the bald general was peeling a strip from a piece of goat meat, munching and dragging stringy parts from his teeth, good eye fixed on the moon.
So how does it feel? This is always what you wish for, is it not?
He flicked his head back over the camp.
To be a soldier?
Hattu felt the chills stiffen around him. He looked back across the mountain camp and saw the bronze ring of Mercedes guardsmen around the king's wagon.
He wanted you to break me, didn't he?
Silence.
That's my job,
Karunta said in a low, expressionless voice.
And I realize that now. I don't begrudge you for any of it.
Hattu flexed one arm straight out before him, seeing the ribbons of shadow and moonlight that marked out his hard-won muscles.
I long to be a soldier because that is what my father was.
Is.
Before my time at the Fields of Bronze, I spent long summers left back in Hattusa, dreaming of making him proud, of being a shield for him, as Muwa is. To stand alongside the great King Masili. That was the dream. And now I have passed through the military academy and find myself here on campaign. Yet he is barely able to speak. When he does, his words to me are still curt, frosted. He will never truly trust me, will he? Even as he gave me the cup of wine at the victory ceremony after the chariot ordeal, or when he consigned me to march with the ranks, I could see it in his eyes. He fears me still.
He fears the gods, Karunta corrected him, and what they show him.
You believe Ishtar's song?
Hattu asked. Karunta shuffled awkwardly.
The king was a different man from that moment onwards.
Do you believe it?
Hattu repeated.
I don't want to,
Karunta replied, shooting a nervous look at the sky, as if worried that the moon god might hear and tell his kin. Hattu sighed, looking over towards the royal wagon.
What does it matter? Now I fear it is my father who is broken.
Karunta's pitted features creased a little.
When I was a young soldier, a mere spear stand like you,
he said deadpan,
I fought in the Mitannian Wars, out in the hot east.
I know where Mitanni was, Hattu said.
Aye, of course you do. Old Ruba may be gone, but his wisdom is not.
Karunta's face bent into something akin to a sad smile.
Once a great power in the world, the people of Mitanni made the mistake of plotting against the Hittite Empire. Now they are no more than a fable.
He looked up at the stars, his silver braid coiled across his neck like a scarf.
Out there I served under a beast of a general. Lerma was his name. Imagine you could catch a lion's roar and mould it into a man. That was Lerma. His mind was keen as a blade. When his fellow generals were planning for the day after tomorrow, he was already setting in place his designs for the next moon. He marched with us, broke bread with us, took his share of marching burden and endured our every hardship. I would have died for him, gladly.
He patted the crossed sword belts on his chest.
Yet it was not to be. He is gone, and I wear his war garb in witness to his legend.
What happened to him?
Hattu asked.
He routed the Mitannian chariot elite with half their number of vehicles and only a small party of infantry. Won us the battle and the war. On the way home, he went to his stallions, who had served him so well the previous day, to feed and water them. One of them had taken a cut to the eye, and it was agitated, nervous. I saw how it nickered and snorted, but the more he tried to calm it, the more anxious the stallion became. It reared up and thrashed its forelegs in the air.
Karunta paused to spit into the dust.
A hoof caught Lerma on the temple. He was fine, or so it seemed. He waved away his closest comrades who rushed to aid him. Later that night, he fell asleep by the fireside before he'd even eaten. Most thought he was merely tired after the exertions of the war. But the next day, men noticed how distant he seemed. He became weak, easy to tire, and shambling in his gait. I was sure then that he was a spent force. But I noticed something. Every day he took to drawing out in the dirt the routes and the supply strategies for the division. Wily and careful in every aspect. While the horse's hoof had robbed him of his strength, his mind was as sharp as ever. The fire still burned brightly within, he said, tapping his temple. The healers insisted Lerma could not ride or march any longer. Yet we soldiers did as soldiers do. We formed a shell around him, refused to heed the advice of the healers and others. It was for the good of the division, and the good of Lerma. Every day we carried him from his bed and helped him onto his chariot, strapping his weakened legs to a frame within that allowed him to stand, to ride, and to see the battlefields, to direct us with his expert eye. We were the division's legs and arms, he was its mind. We won another 6 clashes like that, and Lerma embraced us all like brothers after each, weeping, thanking us for our support. After a few years, the king of the time, your grandfather, forced Lerma to retire to his estate, thinking the offer of a life of comfort would be a gift.
Krunta shook his head slowly.
He died within a few days. The crack to his skull damaged him, but it was the loss of his most trusted comrades that killed him.
The general looked Hattu hard in the eye.
The king needs strong men around him now. Nuanza, Coulter, and I will do what we can, but it is you and Muwa that matter so much to him. You and your brother are the only things that can keep the fire burning within him. He heard your crossed words at Backer Hill.
It was because of Atia, Hattu said.
The young priestess on the Topeka pilgrimage.
Aye. Now she is in Pitaga's hands.
Hattu threw a cold look northwards. Somewhere out there. She means a lot to both of us, and it was a misunderstanding, Hattu insisted. But the anger still stung at his breast, even as the words came out.
A misunderstanding on Mua's part.
Aye. I truly hope so, Karunta said, rising. You and Muwa will make strong leaders one day, when...
He left the rest of the sentence unsaid, looking away awkwardly.
And I have grown to tolerate you both.
Now he really was struggling.
And your bothersome ways, he added with a cough. Now don't stay out here too long. Turn in, get some rest.
He flicked his head in the rough direction of the mountain wolves.
You and your men will need to be sharp, fresh.
Tanku's men,
Hattu corrected him. Karunta made a short grunting noise and arched one eyebrow, then rose and left. As Karunta stalked away, Hattu noticed another figure standing some way away, dressed all in black, one foot mounted on a boulder, watching him, staring. Muwa. His thick mane of hair danced in the mountain wind, the moonlight setting his bright eyes aflame. A moment later, he turned away and was gone. Atia saw blackness and tasted a coppery bile in the back of her throat. The gloom of the rough sack they had pulled over her head seemed to have lasted for an eternity. Voices moaned and mumbled as if speaking in another room. Strange words, yet familiar all the same. Kaskan, she realized with a shiver of horror. Her mind's eye flooded with images of the severed heads on spears the day they had raided Hattusa. Rough hands carried her here and there,
through cold and warmth, through winds and calm, day after day. She smelt clean high air, then the rich aroma of damp earth, and then the stink of horses and pigs. The sack was torn off and she was dumped, exhausted, onto her side on a bed of sorts. It was here that she lay still for some time, barely conscious and unable to open her eyes. She felt a healer's hands upon her, but there was something missing from the healer's touch. It was cold, methodical. Whoever it was pressed chill swabs against the back of her head roughly, carelessly. After one session of prodding and dabbing, a tear fell asleep. When the blackness receded and she woke again, her head ached as if it had been struck by a hammer. Voices, angry and loud, pealed nearby, though she could not understand the mountain men's native tongue. Then another voice spoke, and at once she understood.
"You risked much by seizing the silver god," a voice said in the Hittite tongue. "Too much. Had word of this reached King Masili sooner than it did, he might have ordered his divisions to turn away from the mountains and towards Topeka, to intercept your bandits."
Atiyah's head swam. That voice.
"Nonsense," another voice said in Hittite, but with a Kaskan twang.
"Masili is obsessed with tracking me. In any case, my man infiltrated Hattusa, planned the ambush well, and brought me the prize I asked for. We always needed silver to fund this war. It was an unexpected prize to steal their holy women, too. All the more bait to draw the Hittites through the mountains to these parts. And are the divisions of the Grey Throne not right now marching to this land?"
"And they are right now halted at the spine of the mountains, awaiting my word,"
the hauntingly familiar voice corrected the other speaker. She began to prise open an eye, seeing the interior of what looked like a dome of dried mud and twigs, like an oversized bird nest turned on its head. The light from a pig-fat lamp nearly blinded her, but after a few moments her eyes adapted, and she could see the gloomy home she was in. She was lying on her side upon a bed of bracken and ferns. The lamp sat on a low, crude table on the dirt floor. Nothing else. Then she rolled onto her back and saw, at the foot of the bed, an arc of dim pre-dawn light, a doorway. A cane grating covered the doorway like a cage, but beyond she could see the edge of a colourful forest and a few other such mud dome huts dotted around. She blinked and rubbed her eyes, seeing the wagon with the silver statue of Tahunda resting there, uncovered, shamed, bedecked with Kaskan trinkets and painted in their gaudy dyes. Her heart wept at the sight. Bearded, tousle-haired Kaskan men sat around dung fires, naked to the waist, tearing at joints of roasting meat like wolves as blue smoke billowed from the burning manure. Kaskan women, bare-breasted, danced around the men and the stolen wagons to the buzzing tune of a flute, drunk, faces painted in streaks of red. And then she saw him. The handsome amber-haired fellow, bare-chested like the other men, his chin now sprouting with the beginnings of a shaggy beard. He tore at meat with the rest, some slapping his back and offering him congratulatory beer.
"Fine work, Bagrats,"
one barked gruffly. Shame crept over her as she realized it had been her fault. She had talked loosely with the man, told him of the high road and the low road. Her wretched thoughts were scattered when two figures stepped over the cane grating like jailers. The two she had heard talking. Pitaga, crowned with a lion's skull, eyed her like a lecherous drunk, a greasy half-chewed pork steak in one hand, his red beard stained with pig fat. The one with him, however, beheld her like a treasure.
"Volker,"
she croaked. He peered through her as if she wasn't there.
"The silver effigy will buy us many mercenaries,"
Pitaga enthused, looking over to the wagon and the statue of Tahunda.
"Already more tribes of different blood come to my side simply because they've heard that the great storm god of Hattusa lies in my camp. And I've sent word again to the distant Azi, telling them that I can pay them what they seek."
Volker looked around with a doubtful eye.
"Talk of great numbers is all very well. And all I see here are your 12 Kaskan tribes. 10,000, I told the Labana. Yet you probably only have 8,000 here."
Pitaga threw his head back and laughed.
"I will tell you all, in good time.
Volker's nose wrinkled in disapproval at this.
Be sure that you do. And remember how important I am to your ambitions.
No one man will make or break me,
Pitaga said stonily, with an ill-fitting smile.
Don't be so sure,
Volker said, returning his cold gaze to a tear.
For I may well have found the key. The Azi and the many tribes will be crucial, and the statue is a fine prize. But this priestess is the most valuable of them all,
he said in little more than a whisper.
Volker,
she whimpered, backing up against the back wall of the hut, drawing her knees up to her chest. She saw two Hittite eaglekin being carried on poles across the clearing behind Volker and Pitaga, trussed by their arms and legs like animals, their necks opened and their lifeless faces sheeted with dried blood.
She will bring you what you wish, Lord Pitaga,
Volker continued, as if a tear had not spoken.
If my potions do not suck the life from King Masili, if the snares you have laid out in these lands do not crush his army, then this priestess will break them from within. The two princes, the king's last hopes, yearn for her, and grow resentful of one another.
What have you done?
She croaked. They ignored her. Volker, turning to the fires, then looking out over the surrounding forest.
But first the snares. Be sure to stock your fires high, and let them burn brightly at full light. If all goes to plan, then come the next dawn, this clearing will be heaped high with Hittite dead.
Chapter 16. The Dark Woods of Hatenzuwa. Early summer 1300 BC. Morning came, and the soaring mountains, cadaver grey in the twilight of the night before, now shone like coral. The Hittite army struck camp and climbed the last stretch towards the spine of the range, the highest point of the pass. By noon, they came to the jagged ridge, bare apart from an ancient stone stela, erected by some long-forgotten king, all framed by the pure blue sky. The chill zephyrs whistled and sang. The Fury Division at the head of the column crested, then poured over the ridge first. Next came the storm. Hattu crested the ridge and drank in the sight of the land below and beyond. The mountains descended into a low land, emerald and gold, with rounded hills and river valleys, teeming woods and squat cliffs draped in lush greenery.
The lush north,
Dagon cooed, as they at last began their descent.
Aye,
one grey-haired veteran of the storm nearby whispered in reply, then pointed to the tract of dense forests hugging the foot of the mountains.
And first we must make our way through Hatenzuwa.
A dark maze of woods and necromancers,
a comrade replied. Karunta's head switched round at this, his lone eye wide.
Hatenzuwa, a land that was once ours,
he corrected them. He held his spear out like an extension of his arm, swiping it across the northern horizon.
As all this once was, all the way to the upper sea, the mother of the rivers, the edge of the world.
And that?
Dagon asked, pointing to an odd rock formation in the distance, near a river, incongruous with the surroundings. Splinters of grey stone rising from the Hatenzuwa forest, and largely coated in moss and vines, almost completely swallowed by the vegetation.
That is... was... Hakmis,
Karunta said wistfully.
Hakmis,
Hattu mouthed. Many of the soldiers gasped and repeated the name. They had only heard tales of the place, the nearest of the three fallen holy cities, lost many generations ago to the Kaskans who raised it and drove the Hittites from this strange land. Hattu struggled to tear his eyes from the sight as they marched on down the mountainside. He could not help but think of Ruba and the teacher's tales of these lost lands, stories of imagined adventures and the elusive glory of reclaiming them.
Old tutor, you should have been here to see this with me,
he said quietly.
Ease, lad,
Karunta said, in an uncharacteristic whisper, so no other would hear.
Ease.
Hattu stretched a fraction taller.
Wherever Pitaga is, we will find him. All this, all of it,
Can be ours again. Kurunta's lips bent a little in a wry smile.
There was a boy I knew who once spoke like that. As if victory was a certainty.
What happened to him?
He lost an eye and realized he was mortal.
Kurunta grinned, then jogged on ahead.
Forward!
The army crunched down the mountains, descending from the cold heights into warmer, humid air. They eventually halted on a broad, grassy spur that overlooked the forest. The generals drew together around the royal carriage, pointing this way and that. There was talk of the missing Gal Masedi, and confusion about where he had gone the night before. Hatu, Tanku, and Dagon crouched around a small fire, chewing on flatbreads freshly baked in the flames, eyeing the land ahead. The Hattanzuwan woodlands, just below, seemed impossibly dense and impenetrable. Hatu noticed his comrade's eyes combing over the roof of leaves nervously, gulping, dry tongues darting over dry lips.
No homie can move through such a maze,
Kistner whispered. We may have to. It'll be just like the forest drills we did at the Fields of Bronze, Hatu said, belying his own doubts. We move carefully, stay in sight of one another, keep our eyes sharp.
Slowly, steadily,
Tanku replied, encouraged.
But which direction do we take?
Dagon mused. Hatu dragged his gaze over the jumbled roof of green. Dagon was right. No tracks, no telltale dust clouds from enemy boots or scatterings of disturbed birds. His eyes did snag on a large break in the trees, a huge oval-shaped clearing, about 3 danna in the distance. His grey eye arched, and he saw the small dark brown shape sweeping across the sky above the clearing. Arrow.
There's something in there, he said.
Only when he became aware of the many heads nearby turning to him did he realize he had spoken.
Ah, so,
the slit-eyed captain of the Leopard Clan grunted. Hatu recalled the fellow's efforts in dissecting the poor sparrow at the camp on the first night of the watch. Now his demeanor was awkward, like milk and wine curdling. The old, fading mistrust mixing, ever since the events at Backer Hill, with a droplet or two of respect. Hatu pointed to his falcon.
Bird signs, he said.
Kind I trust, he added inwardly. The men muttered, craning necks and shading eyes to see Arrow.
How can you be sure? One soldier grumbled.
Suddenly a riot of breaking twigs and snapping branches sounded from the foot of the spur, from within the trees.
Archers,
Nuanza rasped. A score of bowmen were on one knee, bows knocked and trained on the spot. Hatu's heart thundered. Like a brawler being tossed out of a tavern, Volker emerged, panting, coughing, dishevelled. He scrambled up the steep path leading onto the spur, 1 foot bare, blood spattered on his horned helm and his cheek bearing a gash as crimson as his cloak. And he was sopping wet, streaked with marsh slime.
They're in the woods, he panted, in the northern clearing. We saw them, but the 2 riders with me were shot through with arrows before they could even turn to run.
By the gods,
Slit-Eyes whispered, staring at the clearing, then glancing back at Hatu. The big man rose and joined the chatter with his comrades. Amongst their words, he heard a few that sent a chill across his shoulders.
The son of Ishtar saw it first.
And be quick, and we can catch them. They assume we are still in the middle of the mountains,
Volker urged.
Hold on. If they saw you and know you escaped, then they will also know we will soon be coming for them,
Nuanza argued. Volker gestured to his bloodied robes.
And they shot me, too. Or they thought they did. The arrow skimmed by my arm, and I fell from my horse and into a bog. I hid there in the reeds as they hunted for my body. I heard them laugh when they found my boot, and they seemed to think I had been sucked down into the morass. They gave me up for dead, taking my horse and wandering back towards the clearing. I waited in the mud hours, then ran back. No Kaskan knows I live. They think they are safe, their location unknown.
The generals mutedly called their divisions into order, as if fearful that whoever or whatever lurked in the strange forest might hear.
Can we be sure?
Hatu heard them muttering. Just then a series of wispy grey columns rose from the clearing, growing dark blue. The army babbled in interest.
See?
Volker exclaimed.
And they cook and celebrate around dung fires, unawares that the mighty army of the Grey Throne watches on.
Arrows swept across the top of the forest, arcing round to land on Hatu's shoulder, screeching in Volker's direction over and over.
"Is it true, girl?"
he asked her. She was agitated, that much was certain, stamping her feet on his shoulder. Eventually, Muwa stood on a rock and announced that they were to enter the woods and converge upon the clearing in a bullhorn formation.
"For the silver effigy! For the captured priestesses! For the gods!"
he growled. The army responded with a gruff chorus of agreement. They set off, crunching down the scree path that led from the plateau to the edge of the Hattanzuan woods. The scouts dismounted and went barefoot into the trees, spreading out like the fingers of a hand, searching through thick hair. The three divisions spread from a 30-man wide column into three fronts, 500 men wide, 10 ranks deep, poised on the edge of the tree line. Whispered prayers to the spirits of the woods sailed up into the air, before they plunged forwards into the green maze in the direction of the clearing. Hattu set Arrow off in flight and stepped into the trees. At once the air became muggier, hot, still as a tomb, and tinged with the odour of musty foliage. They moved at a slow walk, most men half-crouched, spears twitching at every quivering branch or falling leaf. The woods were not so thick at first, with elm, lime, chestnut, and beech spaced well enough to allow them to make decent headway across the bracken floor. It was not too dissimilar to the older woods near Hattusa, Hattu thought. He took to glancing across the advancing men either side of him, to be sure they were moving in line. The wolves and the veterans wore owl-eyed expressions, faces beaded with sweat. From somewhere above the trees, Arrow did her bit by keening every so often, as if to keep them in touch with reality. At one point, Hattu looked up, and was overcome with fright as he saw a cluster of dark shapes up in the branches. For that heartbeat, he was certain it was a band of Kaskan warriors, poised and ready to leap down upon them. But in the next, he realized it was just a set of large, abandoned nests. The deeper into the trees they penetrated, the thicker the woods grew, and the fewer the shafts of sunlight became. Strange bird calls trilled and sang from the shade. After what Hattu reckoned was a 2-danna trek, they entered a dark labyrinth of tall, sprawling rhododendrons. A sea of pink, purple, and dark green, along with the night-black shadows where the canopy of leaves blocked out the sun entirely, and pools of swirling grey vapour where the dampness and the stifling heat mixed. Surely a lair of dark and vengeful forest spirits. And Hattu noticed how he couldn't even hear Arrow's calls anymore. Myriad strange insects croaked and chirped as they ventured deeper. Wet bracken, leaves and twigs crackled and snapped as they walked, now no longer in tight formation, men spreading out to take the clearest route forward. Hattu looked either side of him, seeing Tanku and Dagon, who had been right next to him for the whole march, now 10 paces distant. They slipped in and out of view thanks to the vapour, now thick and heavy like wet linen. Tanku cursed as time and again his green cloak caught on branches, and Dagon groaned as creepers snagged on his spear tip every few paces. Sweat traced 100 paths down Hattu's skin in never-ending rivulets, so humid it was, and the faster he drank from his water skin, the more copious the sweat became. Before long, his water was gone, and his head throbbed, demanding more, and it was only mid-afternoon, he reckoned. At one point, Tanku had strayed in front of him, and Hattu saw shapes writhing on his shoulders. To his horror, he saw that it was a scurrying clutter of spiders. The white, wool-like traces of spider eggs still stuck to Tanku's cloak, where he must have brushed against and ruptured them. Tanku hadn't noticed. So carefully, Hattu reached forward, lifting one hand and skillfully brushing the 8-legged denizens of the forest off with one stroke.
"Hattu,"
Tanku said, jolting.
"You had a vine on your back," Hattu lied.
On they went until the forest floor before them was freckled with livid crimson toadstools and stumps of bedrock, coated in a silver lichen that seemed to glow from within. In the occasional spots where oaks had managed to sprout up amongst the horde of rhododendrons, they were draped in weightless pale streamers of the same lichen, which wafted as they passed like an old woman's hair. Creepers and vines hung like nooses, sometimes so thickly Hattu had to part them like curtains or slice them with his spear to progress. Likewise, he had to bend back, clawing branches, and scramble over knotted roots where trees had grown too close together. his skin itched with what felt like 100 bites, cuts, grazes, and scurrying insects. He heard the groan of a bending branch, and then a thwack, and Tanku, several paces away to one side, yelping, followed by a hushed, if not entirely genuine, apology from Dagon. They saw pale, waxy orbs dangling from branches and clinging to the wrinkles on tree trunks. Beehives, Hattu realized. The sight stirred some memory, something Ruba had told him, something he was infuriatingly unable to recollect. On they went, until at last they saw a golden glow ahead. The clearing.
Slow,
Karunta's voice hissed from somewhere in the arboreal gloom. At once, each of them fell into a warrior's crouch, spear levelled. Hattu glanced left and right, seeing the moor of spear tips nearest him. He looked ahead, thinking of what lay in the clearing. Pitaga and his mountain men. His heart pounded fiercely, and his mouth grew as dry as the ashes of a pyre as he recalled the clash on Backer Hill. Then he thought of the taken priestesses, of the great silver effigy of Tarhunda, of poor Sarpa's head, of Ruba, of Garin, of a tear. He reaffirmed his grip on his spear, and his fears backed down like an obedient dog.
"We are the Mountain Wolves," Hattu growled in a low drawl.
"We will have vengeance for our fallen,"
Sargis replied from nearby.
"With the son of Ishtar and Tanku the Giant, we are unshakable,"
Dagon said, his voice quivering with pent-up ferment. Their careful pace picked up from a slow stalk to a walk to a quick walk. Then they broke into a jog and a run. The light grew stronger, brighter at last, the air cleaner, more plentiful. It was as if they were about to surface from a dark pool. Hattu filled his lungs, ready to cry out with the others as they poured towards the clearing. The front ranks of the bullhorn of soldiers burst into glade, the air shaking with their cries. Emptiness greeted them. No caskins, nothing. The war cries faded and they slowed, looking around the deserted space. Hattu squinted in the late afternoon sunshine and saw the abandoned dome huts, the spent dung fires, now just embers. Recent prints of boots, wheels, and hooves marked the flattened grass. A small brook ran across the space. Not a soul to be seen.
"They were here, but they've left,"
a scout said, kneeling by the remains of one fire. No Atea. But there was a stake rising from the largest ash pit. Tied to it were four bodies, lashed there by their wrists. They were merely shapes of men, black as pitch, their flesh and bone burnt through. Hattu scrambled forward, sliding to his knees, hands raking the ashes. In it he found a sliver of hide, a piece of a Hittite helm, blackened but etched with the wing of a bird. "These are men of the Eaglekin," he said. He looked up, seeing Muwa emerging from the trees, eyes wide on the burnt corpses. Hattu ran his fingers through the ashes again, still warm. He stood and looked at the direction of the prints in the earth, all leading into the northern tree line. He glanced up to the sky, seeing that the sun was dropping and dusk would soon be upon them. An interminable itch stabbed at him, a fiery desire to be on the move again. Atea, find Atea. He clambered up a moss-covered rock near the center of the clearing and craned his neck, giving himself just enough height to see across the forest roof. The woods ran for another danner, and then a green haze of open countryside followed. Such a short way. In his mind's eye, he saw the caskins just beyond the woods, Atea bound and helpless. A fire of pride and anger flooded his mind, and he felt an urge to rush through the trees himself. If there was just a patch of a chance to stuff Muwa's unjust words of blame back down his throat.
"A good soldier chooses the right time to march, and the right time to wait," Karunta muttered just behind him. "That will be the hardest danner we've ever trod. Roots, vines, uneven ground. We'd still be fighting our way through it when darkness came."
"Does that make it the wrong choice?" Hattu asked.
"I didn't say that," Karunta replied,
rising up the rock to look across the forest roof himself.
"They might be just beyond," he pressed. "What if Pitaga lingers there with just a small guard, the priestesses and the stolen statue? This could be over within hours."
Karunta's lone eye seemed narrowed at the prospect, but he shook his head.
"It will be the Tukantis' choice," he surmised,
Turning to the tree line where the royal wagon was emerging, covered in foliage, Muwa directing the driver with waving hands and shouts. Soon the three divisions entire had poured into the clearing, near enough filling the space. They stood in their groups awaiting orders. Muwa, Nuanza, Volker, Coulter, and Korunta gathered by the royal wagon. Hattu, standing with the wolves, saw how Coulter, Korunta, and Nuanza weighed the virtues of staying and making camp here against moving on and trying to escape the last stretch of forest in the final hour or so of daylight. Volker, on the other hand, seemed certain that it would be folly to leave with darkness so close. Muwa seemed swayed by the Sherdan's convictions. Hattu felt his mind and his heart swing one way, then the other. His head said stay, and his heart said go, still imagining himself ploughing headlong through the undergrowth alone. He wandered from the wolves towards the generals.
"Perhaps we should do both," he said.
The general swung round at the unexpected interruption.
"Forgive me, for I know my voice holds no weight in such company, but I feel we could camp here, but also send a knot of men ahead, to sight and track the Kaskans, maybe even to take back the things of ours which they hold."
He looked at Muwa as he said this.
"You're right," Muwa said. "You have no place in this discussion."
The words were like a stinging slap. His brother then turned his back, closing the circle of generals, his black cloak swishing out like a drawn veil.
"There is still an hour of light left," Korunta said to Muwa, firmly but respectfully. "Maybe an advance party would be viable."
"Like at Baka," Muwa snapped. "Disaster almost had us there, General. More than 100 good men fell thanks to that calamity. And for what?"
"A bigger disaster would have been certain had the advance group not